This week, we're heading to the African continent in the 19th century to talk about the Zulu Empire. If you grew up in Britain and you're above the age of 30, you've probably heard of the Zulus. For the Brits, the Zulus might still be the most famous African pastoral people ever. Why, you say? Well, first and foremost, the 1964 film Zulu, starring Michael Caine, which always used to play every Christmas, for some reason.
Now I have an empire. Ha, ha,
ha. And if you're thinking, why show a film about the military exploits of the British Empire at Christmas? The reason is that in the 60s, Britain still very much had an empire, and was still very empire-obsessed. Even more empire-obsessed than now. And I guess the reason that the Zulu are famous is because of what the opening of the film is about. Not the main bit of the film about a heroic victory of a small bunch of British troops holding out against an overwhelming Zulu force, because technologically superior British armies were typically outnumbered. Now, the reason we remember the Zulus is the beginning of the film, where the British army take an absolute drubbing at the hands of the Zulu Empire at
Isandlwana,
22nd of January 1879.
No one knows that.
This was the first proper military engagement between the British and the Zulus, and the British got their sunburned bottoms handed to them. So, how did a bunch of spear-wielding savages, as many of the British certainly saw them, manage to defeat the most advanced military force in the world at that battle? Who were the Zulu? Where did they come from? And what did this famous victory actually cost them?
We were actually nominated for a podcast for Best New Episode.
Zulus?
Yes, but there's always one next year.
Hey, Phil, did you steal that joke from my Beano magazine joke of the month in 1989 and pass it off as your own?
Did you steal that joke from a 1950s black and white film and pass it off as your own?
This introduction is over.
Countries don't exist anymore.
They don't exist anymore.
Yeah. Now you know what this podcast is for.
Countries don't exist anymore.
And in case anybody writes in about using a Lion King song just because we're doing something African, the original language of the beginning of The Lion King is actually Zulu. Or at least the internet says it is.
So it's just cultural appropriation?
The Lion King is cultural appropriation, so it's impossible to culturally appropriate cultural appropriation.
Do you have any idea what you're talking about?
Nah, not really. But in the South African cinematic release of The Lion King, the whole song was dubbed into Zulu. Indeed, Zulu is still the dominant language of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa, home to the city of Durban. The Zulus are South Africa's largest ethnic group, with as many as 12 million in the nation. That's pretty impressive, given that in the early 19th century, there were probably only about 1,500 Zulus.
Where did the Zulus come from?
We're told they originated from Egypt and went south via Ethiopia, but that's not conclusive, and it probably isn't that important to our 19th century history. We're told that the Zulu people were founded by a guy named Zulu Kamalandela in the 16th century.
Yeah, that checks out. America was founded by Amerigo Vespucci.
Don't think so.
And Bolivia, of course, by Simon Bolivar.
That's not true.
And Great Britain, of course, by Sir Hubert Humphrey's Great Britain.
Huh, didn't know that.
Yeah.
More concretely, the Zulu mainly originated from the east coast of South Africa and were a small clan, part of a larger Nguni clan, who were part of the Bantu people. They'd migrated a century early from Mid-Natal to the Umfolozi River, about 150 miles north of Durban, where they'd lived in an area of 10 square miles, grazing their cattle. Yes, the Zulu economy was pastoral, and reminiscent of our first episode on the Mercians, wealth was measured in terms of cow ownership. Cows were everything. Nguni cattle were trained to respond to whistles. Each Nguni would have his favourite ox, and would decorate them, show them off at social gatherings, and even write poetry about them.
Shall I compare thee to a summer cow? Thou art not as nice.
Only men were allowed to take care of cows, since it was seen as the most important work. farming, cooking, and all the other things were women's work. When the head of the house died, they'd be buried under the cow sheds. Wealthy Nguni could lend their cattle to poorer people who would take care of it and take a share of the milk as wages. This was cattle clientship. Moodilism. A European eyewitness said of Zulu King Shaka,
"Cattle and war formed the whole subject of his conversation."
But cows were so valued, they weren't even really part of the Zulu diet. The Zulu's main food were maize and amazi, a fermented sour milk beverage.
I'm cooking Zulu, what did you grow? I'll make a maize dish, cook long and slow. The only difference is we don't need beef. It's way too pricey, it's for the chief. Why, tell me why, was all this not start right? Milk has a nasty habit of turning sour all at night.
Doesn't sound delicious, but I'm sure it all tastes heavenly, since Zulu actually means heaven, and KwaZulu means place of heaven.
What kind of government did the Zulu have?
So, a kingship or a chieftain called an Inkosi. The king could marry several wives and have loads of kids, but none of them were allowed to inherit. Only later in life would the king marry his great wife, and his eldest son would then inherit the title and herd. One of the benefits of this system is that it stopped sons from getting impatient and overthrowing you. So, having a recognised heir only when you're old takes care of the coups, but it can't have been fun to be one of the many princes who could expect zero inheritance. And as for the political system, Zulu monarchy wasn't absolute, initially. The king or chief was under the law, and he could be punished by his own councillors for wrongdoing or mismanagement. The king was the lawgiver, the judge and the high priest, but it was difficult to get heavy-handed when subjects were very scarce and everything depended on a cattle economy. The king had to take it easy on his people, because if you didn't like the king, you didn't need to rebel, you just took your herd and go somewhere else.
Where you guys? I'm going home.
Then, in the 1820s, the Zulu quickly expanded.
Why in the 1820s did the Zulu quickly expanded?
One of the reasons was the leadership of a man named Shaka. He promoted a new type of warfare among the Zulu. Before Shaka's reforms, warfare was more ritual. It was about throwing spears and showing strength and trading insults rather than a total bloodbath. And should you defeat your enemy in battle, the point wasn't then to conquer them and seize their lands. It was just about knowing who was boss. Shaka was born in 1787, son of the chief of the Zulus, but he wasn't expected to take over. As we've heard, Zulu chiefs would have multiple wives, but the heir would only come from the great wife. Shaka didn't come from the great wife. In fact, he was considered illegitimate, since his parents came from the same clan, and this was a major violation in Zulu culture. In fact, the name Shaka means intestinal beetle. Apparently, this is because people were trying to hide Shaka's mother's pregnancy. But if the name was to cover up a pregnancy, and you had the name intestinal beetle, why would you carry it with you through life?
Inconceivable!
At the age of 7, Shaka was packed off with his mother to his mother's tribe, before being packed off again to the Mtetwa clan, who were like the most important people in the area, controlling a loose confederation of 50 tribes, one of whom were the Zulu. So, Shaka grows up fighting for the Mtetwa and becomes a big star between 1807 to 1816. Partly, this is because he's fighting under a man called Dingis Weyo, who's shaking things up a bit. Dingis Weyo was another of these powerless royal sons, and he was determined to take power for himself and to change the system a lot. One of the ways he changed the system was the way the Zulus fought. Traditionally, you'd fight with your family members, but Dingis Weyo instead starts forming fighting regiments where you'd fight with strangers and were led by a man of ability rather than your flatulent uncle. Dingis Weyo also replaces ritual circumcision with ritual conscription, so at least you get to keep your helmet. Don't know what that means, really. In 1816, Shaka's father died and was succeeded by Sigyana, the heir. Dingis Weyo gave Shaka permission to go and overthrow this heir, take the royal herd, and raise himself a 500-man army from the Zulu people. As we've said, one of the main things new King Shaka did was to change the philosophy of war. Bye-bye ceremonial strutting, hello blood and guts. To make killing more effective, Shaka helped standardise a short stabbing spear called an ikloa, which was best for close quarter fighting. He also promoted enveloping tactics called the bull's horn, where the enemy would be engaged and fixed in place by the strongest warriors, while the men forming the horns would surround them. These attacks would generally be a surprise and come first thing in the morning.
Sounds like a pretty predictable surprise.
Yeah, that's true. It's the last time we'd be expecting them when they...
Exactly the same thing they did the last 50 times.
If that's a Blackadder reference, then hold your horses. I'm going to drop one of those in later.
Woo!
Stay tuned, Existers, for a possible Blackadder reference coming up soon.
But that didn't always mean certain death if you were an enemy. Shaka wanted manpower and was happy to absorb those who submitted, and soon he had a lot more men available to him. In 1818, Dingis Weyo was killed in a battle that Shaka conveniently didn't turn up to, allowing Shaka to add the Mtetwa to his empire, and then in 1826, the Ndandwe were added too. By this time, there's already the concept of regiments, but now Shaka started to reorganise all of Zulu society on a regimental basis. Regiments were 2,000 to 5,000 soldiers strong and were assigned to permanent towns strategically established throughout the kingdom. The barracks were built between two thornbush defensive rings, think organic barbed wire. At the centre of this was an area used for military drills, exercises, ceremonies, dances and court sessions. Known as the Amabuto system, boys were taken from the villages at 14 to grow up in their regiments. It was an apprenticeship that started with cow herding and general dog's bodying until they could start training as soldiers. Soldiers were then expected to live and fight together until they were 35, at which point they could return to their villages and marry if they had served well. At its peak, Shaka's Zulu army had 40,000 soldiers. That's 1/6 of its population. Discipline was strict. Shaka's army had doctors and even an intelligence corps. There were also female regiments to create strong and healthy mothers. Men and women weren't allowed to form relationships or even have sex while still in their regiments. Sex and family were seen as a distraction from training and warfare. In the Zulu state, being old, ill, or just not liking fighting wasn't a good idea if you were keen on living. Going from a population of 1,500 to hundreds of thousands took a lot of organisation, especially when you had to feed 40,000 professional soldiers. Most of this was achieved by a combination of conquest and central organisation, where everything became the possession of the king, and then things were doled out accordingly. Shaka's subjects were to think of themselves as Abantu bi Nkosi, people of the king. When approaching him, they said, Bayeti Wena Baba, hail the father of the nation, then had to kneel and say Bayeti Wena Nkosi, hail his majesty, when addressing the monarch. There are lots of stories about Shaka, either praising him far too much or suggesting that he's basically Satan. Most of them are a bit fishy. In one, he has a pregnant woman cut open, just because he's curious. One of the less Nazi concentration camp doctor one is an origin story.
When Shaka was a young teen, he was herding cows and lost them all. He was so devastated by this that he vowed not to lose any cows ever again.
Yeah, it's not much of an origin story. And how do you lose cows exactly? They're massive. If you said keys or Bluetooth earbuds, I'd believe you.
I mean, it's a metaphor. You know, the cows are the people, he'd take care of them and with love and discipline.
Yeah, but recently you lost Bluetooth headphones down the bed in our hometown of Cheltenham.
Mm.
I've never seen you lose a cow down the side of the bed yet.
That's true. But I have lost a burger underneath a table.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, so yeah. It's a scale thing, Phil.
That's fair enough.
Yeah.
But anyway, didn't he invade loads of different herds, killing lots of cows and scattering more in the process? The story should just be that Shaka lost some cows and thought, I'd better get some more cows and my eyes tested.
I'm not saying it's a very good origin story.
Okay. So having all this power, Shaka kept his cool, right?
Not so much. A failed assassination attempt on Shaka led to him being pretty suspicious and extra violent, including having people executed for not crying enough when his mother died. And then he got super paranoid that everybody was trying to kill him. And as a result, they did. Three conspirators killed Shaka, and then the conspirators killed each other until there was one conspirator left. Dingani, the new king.
Why does everyone want that much power? It sounds miserable.
Has personal ambition for absolute power led you to an isolated mental health hellscape? Talk to one of our despot therapists at DictatorFix, because even violent megalomaniac psychopaths need reassurance.
Even executing my political opponent just doesn't bring me pleasure anymore.
Maybe you need less tyranny and more tiramisu, fewer meat hooks and a bit more me time.
Thank you, Dictator Fix. I was considering abdication and suicide. Now you've given me the self-belief to unleash a new reign of terror.
So call Dictator Fix today, because even a dictator needs a shoulder to spy on.
But if you shoot for all the power, there's always a chance that people may not love you. When Shaka was being killed, there are two accounts of what he said. Either,
children of my father, what is wrong?
Or,
are you stabbing me, kings of the earth? You will come to an end by killing each other.
I just think he went,
or,
it's probably one of them. But the rise of the Zulu wasn't just the story of Shaka doing stuff. During this time period, other kingdoms were growing in power too.
So why were these kingdoms suddenly on the rise?
Portuguese ships had been landing at present-day Maputo, Mozambique, wanting ivory and cattle as food for the ships. Now, in order to get ivory, you'd need elephants. And without the cheat codes called rifles, this is a very difficult thing to do without a large hunting party. So some historians suggest these mega hunting parties were leading to more organisation on a larger scale. And once you start selling cattle, there's suddenly more competition over how many cattle and how much land you can get your hands on.
And that's why capitalism is best.
Yeah, but there was always trade in Africa, including trade with India going back another 1,000 years or so. It's just that the goods to trade for were getting better.
And that's why capitalism is best.
Right. The ships bought beads, which was both a commonly used currency and a sign of status in Zulu society, as well as manufactured commodities and modern rifles.
And that's why capitalism is best.
And then there were the complications of new crops coming in, which allowed for a population explosion, but at the same time, a massive famine was doing the rounds at the beginning of the 19th century. In short, there was a lot of upheaval, and these great shifts were leading to fighting between clans. Shaka was able to capitalize on this by promising those who joined him that he would bring an end to the turbulence he had helped to cause. It's a classic move.
Join me, and together we can rule the
empire.
In a lightning conquest, the Zulus go from 10 square miles to about 8,000 square miles, or whatever that is in square kilometers. Establishing the Zulu Empire with a population of 250,000, all within 10 years. So, the core area was about the size of Wales, with surrounding client kingdoms putting the size of the Zulu Empire to twice that size. Double Wales, also known as Switzerland.
Famously.
All we need to do is double the size of Wales and we'll have lovely chocolate. And as the Zulu went to work destroying the competition, this led to an exodus of tribes that in turn went on to seize other people's lands using decidedly Zulu tactics, who in turn displaced other people's. It was a brutal domino effect known as the crushing, and estimates for the number of deaths range from 1 to 2 million, with people spreading right the way up the east of Africa as far as Tanzania.
The Crushing might have been a good name for a metal band if the name wasn't actually in really poor taste. Oh, actually, let me check. Oh, so there's an Oxford-based metal band called The Crushing. Their Facebook page says, four men, some instruments, and a childish sense of humour.
Does the world really need more men with a childish sense of humour?
I don't know.
So, the Zulu Empire is formed when the Zulu people go from a bunch of insult-slinging cattle fanciers to black Spartans. Except actually tough, unlike the actual Spartans.
And if you can please look it up and let us know which episode that was, write in to ctdapod@gmail.com, because we can't be bothered.
Put a £10 stamp on a postcard. Yeah.
Stamped address envelope. Don't forget to put one in.
Put it inside 50 stamped address envelopes.
Send to here, but don't put the stamps on it. Just send us the stamps because they are legal tender.
Put them in.
We can use them.
That's right.
What was the Zulu religion?
Zulu beliefs were very much based on spirits and ancestors. 19th century Christian missionaries claimed the Zulu had one Lord of Heaven. But this seems very convenient, since this is what they were trying to convert the Zulu into believing. Yeah.
You have one Lord of Heaven just like us.
No way. Now, here's some rules. In Zulu culture, there's a creation myth about the first man, Unkulunkulu, who created all things. Interestingly, this man wasn't a god, and he didn't leave any laws. He just turned up before time began, got it going, and then died. Yeah. I quite like that idea of the church.
Just a bloke. All right, John.
His name is actually Brian. No, it's not. It's John. It's Brian. John. Brian. But there was and is definitely a supernatural element in Zulu society. Witchcraft was considered very powerful and very real. In fact, Shaka in particular had people executed on suspicion of witchcraft, not for puritanical reasons, but just with the belief that said witchcraft was being directed against him. The Zulu had and have a concept called Ubuntu, which boils down to, I am a human because I interact with other humans and nature. And there's some solid stuff about balance and harmony there too. And slightly less harmoniously, it's important to balance out this story by introducing two other groups of people that are going to be key, the British and the Boers.
What were the British doing in South Africa anyway?
Oh, you know, the usual. Colonisation, exploitation.
Check.
Classic, late modern stuff. The British took over the Cape of South Africa in 1806 from the Dutch during the Napoleonic War, as it was a vital part of the sea trade to the east. But this was in the southwest and well out of the way of the Zulu, so no immediate problems there. This changed in the 1820s when British settlers were placed in the fort of Grahamstown to guard the eastern border against the threat from a people called the Xhosa, who were a much bigger deal to the British than the Zulus. In fact, the British had been fighting the Xhosa for 100 years.
Who were and are the Boers?
From 1652 to 1795, the Dutch East India Company had run the Dutch Cape Colony, which attracted colonists, mainly from Northern Europe. The word Boer comes from trek Boer, basically meaning walking farmer in Dutch and Afrikaans. In English, another name for walking farmer is PlayStation exclusive. Take that, ponies! Whoa!
Ooh,
Xbox FDW, man!
For the win.
Yeah, Starfield is not underwhelming.
Get out of it.
It's fine. Oh, no.
But why all the walking?
In the mid-18th century, a number of farmers started walking north away from the oppressive Dutch East India Company. While they had good reasons, including finding more land for their cattle herds, it's fair to say that the Boers were fiercely independent and didn't like being told what to do by central authority. And this will become a bit of a theme. They repeated this trick in the 1830s when they left British control and ventured north. The British had displeased the Boers by taking the oppressive step of abolishing slavery.
Bastards.
And the Boers loved a good slave authority. Who doesn't? But the disaster that was the crushing had also helped free up land. And conveniently for the Boers, they reckoned that God had come to them and told them that this bit of Africa belonged to them.
The Israelites, the Franks, now the Boers. God is certainly promising lots of land to lots of people, isn't he? Let's hope this doesn't lead to trouble down the road.
Yeah, he's writing checks his holy body can't cash. I was going somewhere with that.
Yeah.
One group of Boers reached Natal and really liked it. And what's not to like? It's both subtropical and super fertile. So they set up their own country called Natalia. Unfortunately, some people already live there. The Zulu. But as one people meet another, It doesn't have to be all bad. Meanwhile, yet more encroachment into Zulu territory occurred when the English-speaking settlers started settling at Port Natal, modern Durban, apparently with the agreement of Shaka. This turned into a very difficult situation. The British didn't want the Boers butting heads with the Zulu or Xhosa, and they effectively wanted to take control of everyone in one way or the other. That said, the British didn't officially annex Port Natal until the 1840s. Popping back to the Zulu timeline, in 1828 Shaka was assassinated, Dingane took over the Zulu, and the Zulu then hit the height of their powers. Now, all they had to do was interact successfully with land-hungry Europeans and everything would be fine.
Said no archaeologist ever.
In 1838, Dingane met the Boer leader, Piet Retief, to settle border disputes. In return for the Zulu respecting their border, the Boers had to return various cattle that belonged to the Zulu. Dingane then invited Retief and 60 or 70 unarmed Boer leaders to his enclosure for a spot of celebratory dinner. Now, if you've seen the Game of Thrones episode with the Red Wedding, you might guess what happens next. If you've only seen up to Season 3, Episode 8, Second Sons, spoilers!
I've only just seen the Red Wedding episode. Amazing stuff. And like 70% of the main characters killed off. I just can't believe there can be many more episodes left before the final and exciting climax. Must be like next episode, is it?
According to the legends of the time, the Boers ate their fill, the dancing started, and then they're all killed. The Zulu then launched a series of raids against the Boer settlements, killing about 500 men, women, and children.
Is this a definitely happened?
Well, there's a lot of myth-making and varying accounts of what happened, but we know that Piet Retief and about 100 Boers were clubbed to death by Dingane's men after a botched land treaty. This may have happened because the Boers rode into their camp on horses shooting guns and that annoyed Dingane, or Dingane found out about the small print of their border settlement and didn't like it, or somebody just committed a faux pas during dinner.
Lord, he's used the wrong knife.
In December 1838, the Boers made a vow to God that if he allowed them to massacre loads of Zulus, they'd build a church unto him. And God must have been like,
well, I created heaven and earth and all life on all planets and galaxies and black holes and quantum mechanics. But a stone and a wooden church, I would know where to start. Okay, it's a deal.
Things came to a head at the Battle of Blood River on the 16th of December 1838, where the Boers created a wagon circle, known as a laager, to fend off the Zulus, killing 3,000 of them in the process. The horns of the bull had nowhere to focus, and the Boers' continuous volley of rifle fire made it hard for Zulu forces to get close. For Afrikaner nationalists, the Battle of Blood River became proof that God had recognised their right to the land.
Silence means yes, of course.
After the Battle of Blood River, Dingane's half-brother, Pandey, decided to ally with the Boers so that he'd be able to defeat Dingane, which allowed him to become King of the Zulus in 1840. Pandey comes to an accommodation with the Boers and they agree their border on the Tugela River. To the north, the Zulu Empire. To the south, Natal or Natalia. And despite infighting within the Zulu Empire, this agreement actually lasted for 30 years, albeit a 30-year relationship with hostility and grudges, also known as marriage.
Hey, am I right?
And then the British had to go and spoil it all by doing something stupid like annexing Natalia.
Why did the British annex Natal?
The British didn't trust the Boers. They didn't trust their influence in Zulu politics or the politics of other African peoples in general. In 1843, Natal was absorbed into the empire on the pretext that the Boers were invading a people called the Baka, stealing their cattle and taking them as slaves. But rather than saying, fair enough, we'll come quietly, the Boers go back to their trekking ways, heading north and establishing two colonies of their own that become the Transvaal and the Orange Free State. And, hot on the Boers' tails, the British start getting involved more in Zulu affairs, thanks in part to a man called Theophilus Shepstone.
Who was the Othaflushlupstone?
Aside from winning the British Empire's silliest name competition every year since his birth in 1817, Theophilus Shepstone arrived as a child in South Africa with his family in the 1820s, who were one of the OG settlers in Grahamstown. And if you're thinking another arrogant imperialist coming to dominate another people, you're not wrong, but Shepstone wasn't quite the bluff ignoramus stereotype you might imagine, being fluent in both Zulu and Xhosa, or Xhosa. Yeah. From his experience and insight, Shepstone believed that African peoples couldn't be ruled directly and should be governed using their own laws and customs. Could you please come to aisle three, please?
Because we're going to maths again.
There's been a spill of blood in aisle five.
It's been an annexation by the cornflakes.
Shepstone believed that African peoples couldn't be ruled directly and should only be governed using their own laws and customs through an intermediary. And to be fair to him, if you will insist on ruling another people you have no business ruling, then I guess this philosophy is better than dressing pastoral people up in starched collars and knickerbockers and saying,
"Your name is now Timothy."
Shepstone moved to Natal in 1845 and becomes Secretary of Native Affairs, and picked himself up an AKA, as Africans known as, and that was Somseo, apparently meaning famed hunter, though the story goes that they started calling him that after he ran away from an elephant.
Yeah, they also called him Brown Trowo, meaning leader with clean white pants.
However, a few decades later, Shepstone had arrived at a position in 1873 where, instead of being the great defender of the Africans, he'd switched to the great oppressor, persuading the British that the best thing they could do is to destroy the Zulu Empire. But like how Shaka wasn't just one person turning history on its head, neither was Shepstone. And his change of heart may be explained by something bigger that happened in 1867. Diamonds were discovered in the Cape Colony, leading directly to Elon Musk tanking Twitter over a century later.
Ah, well, I never liked it anyway.
Yeah, me neither. Follow us on @CTDAPod.
Yeah, @CTDAPod on Twitter.
Or X.
X.
To get at those diamonds, the British needed labour. This led to a mini gold rush with mass immigration into South Africa and a demand for food, transport and lots of things that needed to be built. And since slavery had been off the cards for a little while now, the British needed Africans to volunteer for manual labour. But the Zulu weren't having any of it. They had a pretty good subsistence living, and if they fancied more cash, they could sell their cattle or excess food to the hungry British colonists. Why would they go building railways or mining diamonds for other people? Pointless.
Diamonds are expensive, lead to exploding populations, and then cultural devastation. If you're Zulu, they'll ask you to work in the mines or invade you. Diamonds lead to problems, and they're sharper than a bull's horn. Create land grabs and more white scorn. Not even Shaq could hold back the strong lust for greenbacks. Bloody diamonds!
Yeah, I could cut that, but I'm not gonna.
But that said, the Zulu couldn't help but notice the booming population and the threat of these colonists expanding their operations here and there. And they were offered the perfect home security solution. Guns!
Woo.
All they had to do was go to Kimberley and they would be sold guns. But the Zulu weren't stupid. They could see the existential threat that the British were, and their leader, at this point Cetshwayo, generally speaking, tried to not do anything to provoke the British.
Who was Cetshwayo?
Cetshwayo was born in 1833, the oldest son of Mpande. Like Shaka, he wasn't expected to be chief, but through military prowess and building alliances, he'd able to take on and defeat his brother in 1857 and becomes the next Zulu heir and co-ruler with Mpande. Unfortunately for Cetshwayo, trying not to provoke the British is a difficult business, especially when you're dealing with the likes of Sir Henry Bartle Frere.
Who was Sir Henry Bartle Frere?
Sir Henry Bartle Frere became Chief Commissioner for South Africa in 1877. Frere was already very distinguished and influential, having been knighted for very bravely oppressing some Indians during the 1857 Indian Mutiny. So now he's going to try and use that invaluable experience to ruin some African people's days too.
That's right, a massive moustache.
Yes. Well, you didn't get any appointments unless you had a giant moustache.
No, exactly. And you got each time you got promoted, your moustache would get longer.
It had to be longer.
Longer moustache. We need our leaders. Need a longer moustache.
Douglas, may I speak to you about your moustache? It's 50 foot wide. My darling, I'll never get promoted to governor.
If it's not at least 12 furlongs, I'm fucked.
Frere is sent to South Africa by superiors and told that he has to reorganise South Africa so it can be turned into a neat and tidy confederation within the British Empire. And one of the first steps is to break the power of the Zulus along with other African people like the Xhosa. So, any better?
No. Although I do have it from a genuine South African that it's pronounced like this.
Xhosa.
So Xhosa it is.
So that they can be turned into a properly civilised South Africans / eager diamond miners.
Yeah, probably more on the diamond miners. More on the diamond miners.
Incidentally, Frere isn't told he has to conquer and subjugate the Zulus just to make sure that they know who's boss. And if Frere could do the same to the two Boer republics also...
That would be great. Okay.
But it wasn't made clear to Frere how this was to be achieved, with the British government even saying they definitely didn't want a war. They had one going in Afghanistan, and they didn't want to do another. But that proved tough for Frere. Maybe it was the lure of massive diamonds. Maybe he believed Shepstone's rumours that King Cetshwayo was actually plotting war on the British in a fiendish plan to take over all of South Africa.
Yeah, but that was the British plan, wasn't it?
How could you possibly know that, Blackadder? It's classified information.
It's the same plan that we used last time, and the 17 times before that.
Exactly! And that is what is so brilliant about it. Doing precisely what we've done 18 times before is exactly the last thing they'll expect us to do this time.
It's a ridiculous idea, of course. The Zulu had no intention of facing the British in battle. Frere told the Zulu to basically, be better chaps, work in our mines, or we'll invade you. It's an incredibly poor excuse for an invasion, and I often wonder why powerful nations even bother coming up with reasons when all they actually want to say is...
We just felt like it!
On the 11th of January 1879, the invasion of the Zulu Empire begins. The plan is to send in three columns, one in the north, one in the centre, and one in the south. The 5,000-strong centre column is led by Lord Chelmsford, who's the commander-in-chief. He marches his men to the mountain of Islamwana. He then splits his force again, leaving 1,700 men to form a camp and taking the remainder off to find the Zulu army. These 1,700 were 1,000 regular troops and 700 colonial and African soldiers. The reason that Chelmsford split up his forces is that he'd fought off a completely different load of natives the year before, and he'd had to give them the runaround to even get them into battle. But he was told multiple times that the Zulus were aggressive and not afraid to face you head on, but he refused to listen. As hard as it is to imagine arrogance and a 19th century British colonial commander going together, Chelmsford was arrogant. He was unprepared, didn't do the most basic reconnaissance, and didn't even see the need to, since he figured that one British soldier and a modern breech-loading rifle could take on innumerable amounts of Zulus. Rather makes you wonder why they needed to invade in the first place, really. Just to shoot people, I guess. In the very early hours of the 22nd of January, the Zulu did a surprise attack. Well, it's not, it's just an attack. because it was the very early hours. But they did. They attacked the camp at Islandwana with 20,000 warriors. The camp was completely slaughtered. Chelmsford was actually even told the Zulu were attacking the camp, and he dismissed it as alarmism.
Poppycock! God's rather balderdash! Attack? Someone must have stepped on attack. Yes, that's the scientific explanation.
This has gone down in British history as one of the most cataclysmic defeats of all time. And Chelmsford has to bear the blame. Yes, the camp was taken by surprise, but the optimal response was to lager the wagons, i.e. put them into a defensive circle and let the attrition of the rifle fire do its thing. Chelmsford had instead ordered that should an attack occur, the wagons should be lagered, and then, away from the lagered wagons, the regular troops should form a line with colonials and Africans on the flanks. Just what the Zulus could work with.
And this is why Chelmsford would suck at PC games.
Yeah, I mean, what's so ironic about this, Phil, is that British troops instinctively understand how to get lagered better than any other nation on earth.
Hey, Bantz, lager,
yeah. I mean, it was just a countdown until I made that joke, you know.
Yeah. I've been waiting for it.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I thought it was a stellar joke. Was it a stellar joke? The South African colony of Cronenberg.
Yes, indeed, yes, nice. Yes, yeah.
You got any?
Bud Lights.
Great! A few survivors escaped. Have you finished?
Tuborg.
A few survivors escaped to Rorke's Drift, a nearby supply camp on the river, inhabited by only 100 fit soldiers and 39 ill soldiers. The first instinct was to flee, but one man called Dalton said that that's the worst thing they could do when facing the Zulus. As the Zulus will always be able to track them down and kill them, the better option is to form a defensive fortification and fight. 4,000 Zulus attack. These were the reserve that didn't fight at Islandwana, and over the next 12 hours there's a raging battle. Possibly 1,000 Zulus are killed as opposed to just 17 British troops. Heroic stuff! Except after the battle, 500 Zulu POWs are then executed. Which I don't remember Michael Caine saying at the end of Zulu.
They're saluting you. They're saluting fellow braves.
Oh, great! Shall we execute him then? Yes, why not?
That said, the Zulus apparently did the same thing at Islandwana, including disemboweling their captives. So, revenge. The thing is that Britain bigged up Rorke's Drift to take the edge off Islandwana. Islandwana should be more famous. Chelmsford should have been sacked. In fact, Rorke's Drift was used as a political crutch to prop up the government in Britain. And, as a British person, I hate that the Christmas film we grew up on was the hangover of some propaganda to save the career of a few politicians. It's monstrous. Oh, and if you want to hear what I think of the film Zulu...
Join us for the next episode!
9 out of 10.
Yes.
The final battle came 6 months later at Alundi in a great victory for Lord Chelmsford, or at least according to him. Actually, it was probably more of a great massacre, after which the Zulu captives were all killed again in revenge for Islandwana. Can you get double revenge?
No, you can only get single revenge. Double revenge means you've started the whole revenge cycle again, because now they have to get revenge on your revenge to balance things out. Revenge.
It's funny, but all of that sentence made sense to me.
Revenge.
But saying the British did this and that so we can feel righteously angry is probably wrong, although quite easy. The fact of the matter is that colonial authorities had a lot of leeway to act as local experts without too much central interference. But this led to bitter enemies within the British leadership who had very different political outlooks and beliefs. Okay, there were probably not that many people saying this whole empire thing is totally wrong, but a very wide variance on how much of it should be done and to whom. And it wasn't just factions. Even with steamships and telegrams, it could take up to 6 weeks to get a message delivered from London to South Africa. and 6 weeks was a very long time to disobey orders and say, sorry, old boy, I didn't get the message. So lots of powerful people back in Britain weren't happy with the way that Lord Chelmsford had conducted the war, and a new man, Wolsey, came to sort things out. Cetshwayo was captured and exiled to the Cape. Then Wolsey broke the Zulu Empire into 13 different chieftains and appointed leaders who were hostile to Cetshwayo. The result of what this became known as the Kilkenny Cat Settlement, which, surprise surprise, meant civil war amongst the Zulu. Cetshwayo briefly returned, unity was not restored, so the British roll in to bring peace by killing off all the elders and leaders at a second battle of Ulundi. Cetshwayo died in 1884 and left an heir too young to unite behind. Zululand was then made part of Natal in 1887, and after further unrest, Ulundi, the Zulu capital, was burned on the 4th of July 1894. Now, the British have a bit of a fascination with the Zulus. This was obviously a time of great racism, of course. But the Zulus were seen as magnificent specimens, fit, strong, and not degraded. The Zulu Revolution amazed the Victorians. Shepstone called it so wonderfully strange, and decided that Dingis Wayo, the predecessor of Shaka, must have stolen his ideas about government, standing armies and training from white people.
Of course. Makes sense.
The Zulus were admired as a martial race. There had been discussions to make a Zulu regiment within the British Army. There was also discussions about the fashion of getting a Zulu to be a manservant in white linen to show off to your dinner guests at your colonial mansion.
Wait till you see the whites of his linen. You won't believe how white he gets that linen.
Of his pants. But the Zulu people aren't some exotic novelty. In fact, they continue to survive under British rule and then apartheid South Africa, and today thrive in a free South Africa, with a new king, Mrs. Zulu Zulu, being crowned in 2022 in an 85,000-seater football stadium in Durban. Mrs. Zulu Zulu's name means strengthening the Zulus.
Too sharp cuts, but won't you tell me how they did it? How did Zulus beat the Empire with so few slew? If tribes knew how they did it to them that had joined in
Well, thank you very much, listeners, for joining us for this episode of the Zulu Empire. Join us next time for CTDEA Film Club, when, of course, we'll be watching and discussing the film Zulu from 1964 with Michael Caine. Oh, my master, why do you only boast to blow the bloody doors off the Batmobile? So have a watch of it, if you like, and then we'll discuss it all together. That'll be fun, won't it? In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with us, ctdeapod.com. Please leave us a review. And if you'd like to give us a little tip, ctdeapod.com, there's a donation link there, just to help with the various expenses that go into making this beast. So, all right then, join us next time on...
Countries that don't exist anymore, they used to exist but not anymore. Now you know what this podcast is for, it's countries that don't exist anymore.